From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made May 26, 2010, when Andrew Cuomo asked Rochester Mayor Bob Duffy to be his running mate. Mayor Duffy wasn't long into his second term as mayor, but he said he viewed this as an opportunity to be even more of an advocate for the city he loved, a strong voice in state government that brought more focus to Rochester's issues. Bob Duffy now winding down his four-year term as lieutenant governor and getting ready to take over the role of CEO of the Rochester Business Alliance as Sandy Parker retires. Lately, Bob Duffy's been a leading voice on social media calling for calm and respect for police officers in what has been a difficult stretch of months. This hour, we have a lot to talk about, and I'm glad to welcome Bob Duffy to Connections. How are you?
Evan, great to be here.
Well, thank you for being here. And I get the sense that while you're the lieutenant governor, former mayor, moving over to RBA, I get the sense that you're a police officer first. It's in your DNA. It's in your heart. And on Twitter, where you've been very active lately, you have, I know you've been moved by a lot of what you've seen. It has been a difficult several months. Are you concerned the American public is sort of out of touch or isn't on a good relationship page with police officers?
I think overall people have great respect for their police. I really do, around the state and around the country. I think what you see now is sometimes what happens in any profession. You could take politicians, clergy, any type of profession, teachers, police officers, public sector workers. When you have things happen that are controversial and certainly cause a lot of anger or concern, you have these wide brushes being painted. And as I just said before the show started, I have been involved on both sides of issues in my police career with we've had controversial police-citizen interactions and a loss of life here in Rochester. If you look back in our history, Rochester should feel very proud because even going back to the 70s and 80s, I believe they have worked hard, the police in this community, to try and overcome these tensions and gaps. And the communication has always been extraordinary, and I'll speak for my time as chief and as mayor. I think former Mayor Bill Johnson did a great job bridging a lot of those gaps as well. But we're at a point right now, I do feel, for police officers who go out every day, do an extraordinary job in New York City and Rochester and everywhere in between, and just feel like they're the world's against them because of these high-profile stories and protesters. And I have to say, Evan, I was absolutely appalled with chants by protesters in New York City. Not the protests, because I'm a firm supporter of the First Amendment. Protests are part of our democracy, and I've never quarreled with that. Whether I agree or not or disagree with the content, it makes no difference. But to have people chant, what do you want to see dead cops over and over again? And we just saw that in Brooklyn and New York City recently. We had officers assaulted. And I just think that now you have two innocent police officers in their car having lunch and on a break, who are both executed in their car. I do think it drives home points that a lot of us have always felt, and maybe there just will be a little more balance coming to this whole equation. And just to finish on that point, Officer Darrell Pearson, who I did not know personally but knew of his name professionally when I was mayor, an extraordinary young man, a veteran over in Afghanistan, served our country with distinction, a dad, took his son first day of kindergarten this last September, dropped him off, went to work, and then was doing his job keeping a neighborhood safe, chasing a person who had a gun. And to my knowledge, Darrell did not have a gun in his hand. He was chasing a suspect through a backyard when he was, in essence, murdered. And, you know, I think Rochester has seen the pain of what can happen when you lose a police officer. It means much. It means so much. It means so much to the family, but symbolically, it goes even deeper than that. To have somebody in those positions who is killed in a line of duty or severely injured, I think we all suffer.
Some police leaders in New York City blamed the protesters of the Eric Garner case that you're referring to. And again, it wasn't all of them chanting what you just mentioned, but some did. Some police leaders have blamed the protesters and a man you know, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. They say he's got blood on his hands for the murder of these two police officers. Do you agree?
Well, you know what? I'm not one to blame. I think what I would agree with is there is an environment being created here that maybe did not, you know, the protesters aren't to blame for what this crazy career criminal did 2 days ago, and coming up and shooting those police officers in the head. Obviously, he was troubled. He had a long criminal history. But to feel that, or to make some comments on Instagram or whatever, to somehow tie himself into this is terrible. And the person to blame is the person that pulled the trigger. That's what I feel. I felt that way about Daryl Pearson's murder. I feel the same way about this person in this incident. But maybe what this will do is tone down the rhetoric on all sides. I fully agree. There's always huge rooms for improvement for police community relationships, and you know, communities of color have often, really in my history in the police department, have often felt that there was inequity, and you know, and in so many cases you have to listen, learn, and make adjustments to what you do, and we're here to serve people, and New York City is in the same position. But I do believe the rhetoric will calm down. You had, you know, in two cases, the Garner case and a case in Missouri, you had a loss of life that was involved in police interactions, in essence. In both those cases, there was struggles and resisting arrest. And you had these two police officers sitting in a car who were executed. And I don't draw any parallels to either one other than you have a loss of life. Every family impacted here has lost a loved one, and I think it's time to take a step back and just appreciate what police officers do, look for ways to improve this situation, and you never want to have police officers afraid to get out of their car or feel that they're not supported and don't do their job. Then, if that happens, you will see, you know, far greater problems emerge in New York City and elsewhere.
Yeah, I think Michael Brown is not Eric Garner, is not Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old in Cleveland. Yep. Very different cases, and sometimes they're spoken about as if it's the exact same situation. I'm curious to know, we've got video in two of the three, and in the Eric Garner case, we've got extensive video. And I don't think for a moment that that officer wanted Eric Garner to die, but should he have been indicted for something?
Well, here's my position on it. I saw the video, and certainly there's an awful lot in that video that people can draw a conclusion from. The only thing I've often said is that in my history with the police department and in government, I've gone through a number of, I've testified in countless grand juries in my career, but there have been grand jury findings and verdicts and trials that I have agreed with and those that I've not agreed with. And it can cover a whole host of issues. I've often said, especially in grand juries and with regular juries, they see all the evidence. Maybe I saw part of it. Maybe I was involved in a case, but I didn't see or hear the whole thing. Or maybe my only account was from what I read in a paper or saw in the media. So I always felt those folks, they make their judgment and their decisions, whether I agree or not with it. We have the best system in the world, I believe. And I understand that there will be people that might not agree with that. I'll just give you one quick example. We had a police officer many years ago. I will not mention his name. He still works in Rochester, who on a search warrant tripped going in over wires in a drug house. Gun went off and killed the young man sitting in a chair who was in a drug house. He was not armed. There was no confrontation. A terrible, horrible accident. A terrible, horrible loss of life. The father of that young man came up, and as any father would agree, who cares what my son was doing? He did not deserve to lose his life. The officer was distraught. It really caused a lot of fractures, but there was really something about that case I'll never forget. The father, in the end, came to forgive the police officer. The police officer, who is now a higher-ranking officer in the RPD, wrote this basically handwritten account of what happened against his lawyer's recommendation. Mayor Bill Johnson was extraordinary at that time, who knew the facts. And, you know, in the end, you know, in terms of discipline people look for, should the officer be fired? He was not fired. It was a horrible, horrible mistake. And the city had to pay for that mistake. They could never replace that life. But as I said earlier, I've been on both sides of these things, and they're terrible. They tear families apart. But you have to look for ways to improve the relationships and go on, and not declare war on police officers or the NYPD. It's the absolute wrong thing to do. And some of that rhetoric, quite frankly, is being perpetuated by people who have nothing to do with New York City or NYPD or in Ferguson or anywhere else. And I think it's time for people to just step back and work on the problems. Don't demonize the people.
Yeah, in other words, we don't see everything the grand jury sees. Right. And that can be difficult for us. From what you saw in that video of Eric Garner, did anything bother you?
Well, obviously, he is somewhat resisting. They're wrestling with him. Here's my view. It wasn't the chokehold. I really thought, from my experience, there is a concept called positional asphyxia. We lost a young man in this city in the back of a prisoner transport wagon many years ago. When you are on your stomach, and Mr. Garner was a big man, he was on his stomach, hands behind his back, pressure on his back, it looked like they're trying to handcuff him and get him in custody. I don't know if that was considered, but that's a medical term that there has been a number of people who have died in police custody here and elsewhere around the country on this concept. There's something about hands behind the back, feet up, pressure on the back, that really impacts the breathing. So I don't know if it was that. I've never seen or heard a report, but the first thing I thought about when I saw it, because I know the officer grabbed him from behind, and the NYPD has their rules, and they certainly will take care of their internal rules, but how long it was there and what happened, I mean, judging from the film, I think for me to make a decision one way or another, I'm not saying anything was right or wrong. It's hard to tell. It's a snapshot in time. The internal investigation of the NYPD will probably be much more definitive in terms of what he did, if they thought it was right or wrong. But I still think this positional asphyxia issue probably had to play into that just by virtue of the size of Mr. Garner on his chest. Because we lost a young man here in the city, many years ago, over in the South Wedge, on a very hot summer night, a domestic violence arrest. It was terrible. There was not force used, but he was handcuffed. He was on his chest in the back of a wagon that was not air conditioned at that time. And, a young life was lost, and it shouldn't have been lost.
Do you think black citizens are treated differently by police, especially in urban centers in this country?
You know, I go back in my police career. I think the unfortunate thing is that there are often, due to some neighborhoods that are more economically disadvantaged, there are more policing, more crimes. I have, in my career, I've been in situations and have listened to a lot of anger, but I have found great support in communities of color for our police department. I mean, I've been on, I ran for mayor. I walk neighborhoods as a chief, as a police officer. We have, like any profession, you have interactions that you don't approve of, and not every public employee, every police officer does his or her job the way you want it to. No one does, and you find it in any profession. But overall, I'll speak for Rochester. You look at the hundreds of thousands of interactions that go on every year. And as we talk today, there are probably hundreds going on around the city that everybody's satisfied and happy with. You do have some. And I think sometimes you could have a situation take place where one person's perception may be, why it's taking place. Maybe the police officer is having a bad day. Maybe the citizen feels that I'm being stopped for this reason. And the communication is bad, or maybe things aren't being explained well. And so the person walks away from the police officer thinking that he or she has been targeted or profiled. There are perceptions on both sides that it really, you address that with better communication, better understanding. It's not just training. I think it's basic humanity. But I also have to realize police officers walk into situations sometimes that, they walk in with the best of intentions, and it is out of control. They are looking at safety. They are looking at trying to protect themselves or a person in there, in the house. And when our cooler heads prevail, sometimes it sounds better. But, those officers I have found throughout my career do an extraordinary job every day with few problems. They're well-trained. They're smart. You don't see brutality. Sometimes you have people on the street are bigger, tougher, stronger. It may take five police officers to get somebody to the ground. It's not unusual. And by and large, citizens, while there certainly it can be distrust at times and not a great relationship, I also see countless opportunities and countless times those relationships do exist. In the poorest neighborhoods in our city, people want more police. I can't tell you how many meetings I've been to. They want more cops in our street, more cops in our neighborhood, walking beats. They want them. So I think in the end, there's always room for improvement. There really is, and we have to keep doing that. But let's stop and get a dose of reality that things are not as bad as some may have us think they are.
You've seen a lot of people respond to difficult situations over the years. Have you ever seen anybody with more grace than Amy Pearson?
She's an incredible woman. You know, my wife and I have said this, to lose a loved one. And I've made death notifies in my career, and they are painful. To go to somebody's house and tell them that their husband, their wife, their child has been killed, it is something I'll never forget. She has been just a picture of grace, of class, through one of the most painful things anyone could ever imagine happening in their lives. To be a mom with two kids, have your husband go off to work and not return. I did not know her before this, but she is an amazing woman, and certainly someone who has garnered great respect throughout this region from people that did not know her before this terrible incident.
We're talking to Bob Duffy, Lieutenant Governor, former Rochester Police Chief, former mayor, and the incoming, as of January 5th, CEO of the Rochester Business Alliance, though I suspect... Well, I guess technically you're still the lieutenant governor. I'm assuming that you were already really working on RBA.
Right through. No transitional start until the end of the year. I'm on lieutenant governor duties, but on December 31st, I don't mind telling you this, I'm not a smoker, but I will be having a cigar and a glass of New York State wine somewhere, celebrating 4 years. I've enjoyed my 4 years with the governor. The governor has been great to me. He really has. He's been a friend. He's been a good colleague. He's been a great governor. You know, like any leader, and not everybody agrees with every decision, he's done amazing things for the state. I'm going to miss him. We've had a very, very good relationship, one that I think would probably equal any governor-lieutenant governor relationship in our state's history in terms of closeness and friendship. But I'm looking forward to coming home.
If you want to join the program, listeners, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Bob Duffy in studio with us for the hour. And I wonder, you know, when back in 2010 in the spring, when Governor Cuomo, well, then Attorney General Cuomo, reaches out to you, talks to you about the lieutenant governor post, I don't know anybody who has more enthusiasm for downtown, for the city of Rochester, for the growth of the city than you. And I know you had a lot of what you felt was developing an unfinished business. And your strongest supporters were sort of split. Some wanted to see you go take on this post. Some didn't want you to leave Rochester. And I think that was probably a credit to you. Have you ever looked back and regretted for a moment the decision? Is there any part of you that wishes you would have stayed?
It was a painful decision. I mean, it really was. And I had a great relationship and great respect for then Attorney General Cuomo and for the governor today. But when he asked me, and the governor's told the story several times, for the first 20 minutes, I said no. I actually rattled off a number of names of other mayors that might be better lieutenant governor candidates than I would be. And after about 20 minutes, he started on his end with his response that went on about 45 minutes. And in the end, he went through all the reasons. He told me why he wanted me to join him. He went through a number of things he felt I could do for this city and this region that I could not do. You know, I thought, too, if I said no, I would be the mayor of Rochester and maybe not the best relationship at that time. I don't think that would happen, but I thought that. But in the end, I made that decision. It was very tough. It was very, very painful. The one thing the governor was surprised at, you know, I didn't take that job as a stepping stone to run for something else because at some point in our career together, we had that conversation. He was surprised that I had no intention of running for governor after he left. He asked me why why I joined him, and I said, because you asked me to join you, and I came to serve you. I had no intention of doing that. I had no intention if he were to leave, and if he were to leave to fill in and run. I did not want that. It's not what I desired. I've not lacked ambition, but that's just something I didn't want to do. But he went through a number of things that he wanted to do. It has been an extraordinary experience. I have met people and established relationships I never would have had before. So I've been enriched in many ways. But the pain of leaving at that time has never left me. I never quit anything in my life or walked away. And I just felt that was a very, very tough thing. And he also deeply appreciated what I did because it was very, very hard to step away.
I'm curious to know if you think downtown, particularly in certain projects, would be different in any way. I mean, we look at downtown, the heart of downtown, the goal of revitalization, Midtown and others. Are you concerned about those projects now, especially moving into the Rochester Business Alliance job? What are the top priorities going to be for you, especially in relation to the business community and economic development downtown?
Well, going back to your first point, yeah. Do I think things would have changed or would be different? No, I'm very proud of what we did during our time together and our administration. I'm very proud of what Mayor Richards did afterwards. We kept going, and I'm very proud of what Mayor Warren is doing now in terms of these projects. Things are really moving along. And I drive around quite a bit. It looks great. There's a lot of things happening, a lot of exciting things happening right now. So that is key. And you know, the RBA job, what that is, contrary to some people's belief, it's not a lobby organization. It's a chamber of commerce. It has over 2,000 members. The lobbying wing is unshackled upstate.
But you can't lobby.
Well, there are two schools of thought. I'm going to go with the rules that the state and J-COPE has established. I have a great relationship with J-COPE and our ethics officer in the chamber, who I've throughout this whole process have communicated pretty clearly and consistently with. So I never felt I ever had any conflicts whatsoever. But the state and J-COPE's position is I cannot lobby the chamber directly for 2 years. Chambers, governor's office, colleagues, even my own office. And I'm going to not do that. I'm going to play by the rules and not do that. It does not impact any lobbying with legislatures, so I can still go to Joe Morelli and Joe Robach and our delegation in both houses and both sides of the aisle. But the chamber itself, I can't. I don't have any lifetime restrictions. But based on the virtue of the job itself, I didn't write legislation. I didn't vote on a piece of legislation. And there's a legal decision that has been arrived at by a very prominent attorney here, as well as the board chair of the RBA, who happens to be the former dean of the Syracuse Law School, President Don Brabman from Nazareth, that felt very strongly the top four positions in the state are exempt from that public officer's law provision. But I think it's best to abide by what the state is doing. I intend to. I've told my staff, we may talk socially. I will never call and lobby people that I've worked alongside for the last 4 years. In the next 2 years, not once. I'll play by that. But it really is only a small portion of what my duties are at the RBA.
If you're waiting to talk to Lieutenant Governor Bob Duffy on the phone, we're going to be coming to you in just a minute. I want to make sure we follow up on a couple of quick points there. And here's a question from a listener online. You can join the conversation on Twitter as well. Question on Twitter. I'd be interested in knowing whether the Lieutenant Governor has any regrets about killing Wren Square, $50 million returned to D.C. that could have rebuilt Main Street.
Well, first of all, truth be told, we didn't kill Wren Square. Wren Square was not a city project. It was a county project. And truth be told, on that we had two issues with that. One was just some minor space adjustments on the bus garage, which were eventually addressed. And it was really based upon some concerns of people that own properties nearby. The second issue was the parcel in the corner of Main and Clinton. That was part of it. And the only thing the city wanted at that time was if the money was not raised for a theater, that property would revert back to the city for development. Now, it wouldn't be, in limbo for perpetuity. And we really were hopeful that if it was even close in raising money, we would keep that going. And the project was shut down. I'll defer, the county was their project. We did not shut it down. There was some emotions back then. But I think a lot of misinformation has been fed about this. When the project was shut down, I was in my conference room with Tom Richards alongside me, talking to a city council member who would have been the fifth yes vote for that. It would have been 5-4. I won't mention the council member's name. He did not finalize his decision. He was wavering back and forth, but we were on the phone trying to get that fifth vote. So if you were to ask Tom Richards, he would tell you the same story, and that would reinforce we did not kill Wren Square or try to kill Wren Square. But I've learned in this job, people put things out, and sometimes in Twitter, emails. I mean, I've read so many things about myself that I would not even attempt to try and respond to, because, I'm pretty confident that, if they're right, then I'll accept responsibility. If they're wrong, I just can't spend time going out trying to undo every rumor and innuendo that's put out there.
But one thing that is clear is that you had to make in your first term a brisk and strong decision on the fast ferry, and you did. Yep. And you said at the time, and I hope I'm not misremembering, but essentially you were concerned about a number of things, including, first and foremost, protecting taxpayers. And these are hard decisions because everyone wants strong and high wattage projects to survive and thrive, but you also have to make sure that taxpayers aren't on the hook for a potential bust, even if there's a sunk cost involved. So that happened. Now here you are coming into RBA. RBA is many, many things, but interestingly enough, we have a culture in this state now where public-private partnerships are common. Mm-hmm. Joe Spector for Gannett, I know you know Joe, wrote a piece for Gannett newspapers, including the Democrat and Chronicle, said New York State leads the nation in corporate welfare. So how do you make sure, if there's a project that looks good, that looks like it works, that between the business and government, how do taxpayers know that they're going to be protected, Bob?
Well, it is not a perfect science by any stretch. And as hard as governments work, it could be city, county, towns, villages. Everybody is struggling to try and get development. We're all competing against other states, other regions for development. And there are chances that are taken, and there's no exact science. Often it is the word and the agreements of, you know, you get this amount of money if you create this many jobs. And we've had a number of successes and also ones that weren't successful here in this region. So, you mentioned the fast ferry. That is one I take full responsibility for. Yeah. That was painful because it was started by my predecessor, who I've always had enormous respect for, Bill Johnson. And it was a financial decision that I felt I had to make at that time. But you've never heard me criticize the mayor ever for that. I never did, not publicly or privately, for that project. It was a decision I had to make. But going forward, one of the things that I think we just have to make sure, and we do our due diligence, you can't, when you go into a project, you have to really have people on your team that will dive deep in every financial aspect of this. You know, a mayor, a county executive, a town supervisor, as detail-oriented as we will get, we still need a great team around us to help us with that. And that's what I just would encourage, because there's a lot of great opportunities. This is a wonderful area. It's not just Rochester. It's a Finger Lakes region that is rocking right now. But, you know, you're not going to have all successes. But I do think there's a pretty good track record locally for projects. And I'm seeing a lot. I'm proud of a lot of things Mayor Warren is doing right now with her team. I'm seeing some great things popping up, and I fully support. And I would look at the RBA a way that perhaps in my experience in City Hall and in government to bridge some of these relationships and work with the business community and government, not to increase corporate welfare, as you said, but maybe to look for better relationships, better decisions, and many more partnerships, not just on business ends, but on issues with our children and city schools and things that we could do that maybe we've not done yet that will help raise everybody up in the city.
Last question before we move to the phones. And again, 2 weeks from today, the Lieutenant Governor moves into the role of CEO of the Rochester Business Alliance. You spend a lot of time in the Finger Lakes. I've heard people in the wine industry rave about the amount of time you've taken to learn about what they're doing, to be a helpful voice on the state level. I know they appreciate that. But Unshackle Upstate, of course, had a position that was pro-fracking. And so now you've got a bit of a push-pull here. Did the Cuomo administration, the Cuomo-Duffy administration, and certainly with the help of advisors, did they get the decision to say no to fracking right? Did they get that right?
Well, I think people have to understand with the governor, this is a very, very tough decision. I was not involved in the discussion with this, but I will say, here's where the governor comes from. In a decision like that, you'll never make everybody happy. But his view, if he went forward with it, he just felt there was no guarantee he could do that and guarantee everybody's safety, health, and the health of our waters and our resources. That's the way he felt. There was a strong lobby on both sides, and he knew, and he's known for some time, whatever decision he would make one side happy, one side unhappy. In the end, he made the decision. He did wait. He was not just vacillating. I'm aware of all kinds of reports, discussions behind the scenes. Joe Martens, who is the DEC commissioner, did enormous amounts of work. Dr. Nirav Shah, who's left, our former health commissioner, same thing. And it's a very, very tough decision. When you're in a political office, you make decisions, and to say there's no politics involved, I don't want to say that, but I also will tell you I was not involved with that discussion, so I can't speak to the mindset, but I can speak to what I do know and what I know of the governor and how he operates. He's an incredibly bright man. He's very smart. He is not afraid to make tough decisions. He is not weak. He is not weak-kneed. He is very willing to step in there and take on things that are controversial. I think this one really troubled him because he understands the economic impact, say, in the Southern Tier, but also the beauty of the state, the Finger Lakes, the Hudson Valley, the Adirondacks. I think there are areas he did not want to make a decision that 5 or 10 years down the road he would regret. My sense is if other technologies emerge that create maybe greater confidence, and I'm sure technologies are pretty good now. I'm not going to say they're not. But I would say the governor, if given guarantees, would certainly revisit that decision down the road. But he was pretty adamant when he came out and said it. And I think that's where he stands. And I certainly have heard, from both sides of this issue in recent days. And, as I've done for the last 4 years, I want to support the governor on this. And I know how tough this has been for him because he has strong friends and allies on both sides of this issue. So he knows the outcome, what it means. But he did the very best he could. And, again, I think there are people in Finger Lakes who are very happy with that decision. People in the Southern Tier are probably not so happy.
It's one thing to say you support the governor. Would you have made the same decision?
You know, I have to say this. I'm not exposed to the same information that he has, so it would be tough. But if given all the information, if I could weigh in, I would not be afraid to make a decision either. I would, and my sense is, I understand the business opportunities here. But here's one thing with the gas industry. Gas prices are very low right now, so even taking it out of the ground, it maybe the monies won't be there, and maybe they're on other places. But that natural gas at some point is going to be extracted at some point in our history down the road. And at that point, maybe the prices are much higher. I think it's like money in the bank right now. And so there will come a time when that will take place. But, it goes back to your questions like the grand jury decision. I don't punt questions, but if I have all the information in front of me, I'll make a decision, and I'll make a very clear one. I don't have all that. A lot of the things with the fracking issue, I mean, I've read some reports, but for the most part, I get a lot publicly and on both sides, but I don't have access to all the health research that was done and everything was done for the governor. And my sense is he has everything available. He makes the decision that he feels is best. He did it. He'll stand by it, and I respect him for that.
To the phones we go after a 60-second break here, a very short break. Lieutenant Governor Bob Duffy spending the hour with us. So if you're on the phone waiting, you're next right here on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, it's the music of Downton Abbey. We'll have some live performances in studio. We've brought in the piano. And we'll tell you about an upcoming event. Tickets are still available that you can attend in just a couple of weeks. The music of Downton Abbey, bringing some music to this Christmas week. Next hour, right here on Connections.
All this week on All Things Considered, we'll hear from people who write musical scores for movies.
You know, music is such an odd thing when you think about it behind an image until you take it away, and then you realize that a movie sounds blank without it.
That's Thomas Newman, the first guest in our series Scoring the Screen, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's this afternoon at 4 on your public radio station.
All right, before I get to the phones, and again, I promise to the phones, but real quick before I forget, you don't want to break any news on it. You are absolutely not going to be running for county executive in 2015, are you?
I'm not.
Your name was bandied about a lot in the last year for that.
My name was bandied about when I was mayor. And,
you've heard that before.
I think I went on with Ray Lovato one time and said, not reading my lips, but no, I am not running for county executive. And I think that also impacted relationships over the years because there's all these rumors. And I have thoroughly enjoyed my time in public office. I have. I'm looking forward to stepping away from that and going into the private sector. I have made a commitment for this job. I have no intention of running for office. I would like to support good candidates in the future. I've always been pretty much nonpartisan, but I am not going to run for that office. I guess I can't say it any more unequivocally than that.
Okay, very good. But to the phones we go. This is John in Rochester. John, you're on with Bob Duffy. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Hi, Bob.
Hello, John.
Hi, Evan. I mean, listen, I got to address, Bob, you know, I understand the concerns of being a police officer. This young man that was taken down, he's in his 30s, he's my daughter's age. But in the context of this city, Rochester, this is a great town, by the way. This is a great town. The people in Rochester, this is a great town. But we, you know, we've got the highest murder rate in New York State and highest mortality rate. And I know people in the neighborhoods, okay? I know what they're putting up with. I'm 3/4 Irish and 1/4 Dutch, and I know people here now in the city. I was raised in the suburbs, but it's just that there's no difference between what's going on the forefront and what's going on behind the scenes. I just was at a Christmas gathering with my family, and my sister lives in Cornhill. Her husband's African American, but it doesn't matter. They have friends. They have a neighbor that was he's the youth counselor at a center on Avenue D. Him and his wife were beat up outside the center, you know, just by a bunch of teenagers. And it's just this kind of like a mob violence or fratricide that I can understand to the city cops or any cops, and believe me, the Rochester Police Force is one of the most professional forces that I've seen lately, especially with all the problems we have.
Well, John, you got to let me jump in here because, again, I've got a lot of callers to get to with Bob Duffy here. I think part of the point I'm hearing, Bob, is at least, you know, I mean, I he's showing a lot of respect for what he's seen in Rochester Police, and yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there's violence and there's a lot of perspective to consider, I think.
Well, you know, John, from having a chance to travel around the state and not so much around the country, but it is a phenomenon you see really in society nowadays. I think you have an angrier society of things that happen. It happens in poor neighborhoods. It happens in affluent neighborhoods. You have murders, assaults, all that. You have that. I think when you talk about the crime and stuff, it's scary. It's scary. Some of the threats you see, some of the situations you read about. And I read almost every state newspaper every morning. But I'll go back to your point about the RPD here in Rochester. No organization is perfect, but you know they exemplify, like so many other police agencies, it's a very, very tough, difficult job, very dangerous job. But they do extraordinarily well, and not perfect. I don't blankly defend any bad behavior, but given you know the hundreds of thousands of interactions every year, I'd say probably 98% of those, or 96% or so, somewhere in that range, go superbly well. And so I think we improve the areas we have to, but let's remember that overwhelmingly, they are just a great organization and provide great service.
Different, John, in Rochester, on the question of economic development. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Lieutenant Governor Duffy. It's
Hello, John.
Good to get you back in town.
Great to be back. Thank you, sir.
You know, question regarding economic development. You know, I know New York State. We've got our challenges because of the tax structure, etc., and the private government partnerships. I think are a start, but I think ultimately, when government chooses winners and losers, I think there's a real negative there in the long run. I'll give you an example. There's a project in Buffalo called the Riverbend Project, and I think the solar company is going to be occupying part of that. The
yes.
state is going to step in and purchase. They've already purchased the land. They're going to build a building. To my understanding, they're also going to buy the equipment for the project. The total cost per contemplated new job is going to be something like $400,000 per job. There's a point, I think, Bob, that government's got to step aside and look at really what the bone structure problems are in the state and correct the real problems at the roots, the taxation issues. And I think possibly restructuring government to make New York State, say, a right-to-work state, creating more choice as far as belonging to public unions and not belonging to public unions, to correct some of the real boned problems of the economic structures in New York.
Well, let's let thanks, John, for the call. Lieutenant Governor.
John, go ahead. I understand your point. The Riverbend project, you are correct. There's a big investment there on behalf of the governor and the state. The Nanoscience Center, I know, is pretty heavily involved with that. And the state is going to own the building and equipment and lease it to the company and have the ability to use it in other ways down the road if need be. But one of the things that I found in my time in Rochester, and I find it in my travels around the state for the governor, we are in this deep competition around the country with other states who may have more attractive economic landscapes than we do. Because, you know, the problems we have in New York State were not created by Governor Cuomo. He came into office 4 years ago. He inherited a lot, as other governors have as well. In many cases, I've described it as decades of some ill-advised decisions that brought us to this point. And that is an issue that he has to deal with. So he has looked at ways to incentivize. He has looked at ways to create a more attractive environment for people to come here and bring jobs. He's done some great things upstate. I get a chance to travel around and see that, and see, you know, that jobs being created, groundbreakings, buildings going up. And the hope is that over time, even with Startup New York, which some existing businesses really have not been a big fan of, that those jobs, the economic influx over time will offset that investment. And as I said, I think Evan and I talked earlier, there's no exact science here. I mean, there could be winners and losers with these investments down the road. I don't want to paint a rosy picture that everything works. But given the environment we're in and given that other states are in our backyard every single day trying to draw from manufacturing companies to dairy farms out of here to relocate, New York is really fighting to keep its head above water. And we lose some, and I think we win more than we lose, but you know, the governor has paid very close attention to upstate, contrary to some people's perceptions in terms of investments. But, you know, when I get to my new job, John, if you ever would like, just shoot me an email or a letter over there. I would welcome input and suggestions. Obviously, you know what you're talking about. You have some experience in this area. Would love to do it. I can't lobby the chamber for 2 years, but I certainly could provide information back to our legislators and, like, people like Joe Morelli and Joe Robach, both excellent leaders here in this region, both leaders of the Senate and the Assembly. And I think there are some suggestions we can carry forward. And I think you're going to see much more attention given to Rochester coming and starting in 2015 on behalf of our governor.
Now, before I get back to the phones, quick follow-up here. On election night this past November, we heard Rich Funke, who beat Ted O'Brien for a state Senate seat, say in his speech that if Buffalo got their billion, then by God, Rochester should be next in line. And that's interesting for a number of reasons. First of all, he's a Republican talking about wanting to see an increase in state spending. But he's also doing it from the premise that it worked in Buffalo. Is it working in Buffalo? For those who haven't been there, Bob, I know we get hung up on the Buffalo billion. Are you hung up on it? Should Rochester get more spending, and does it work?
Well, first of all, there has always been this jealousy like brothers, upstate cities. Rochester looks at Syracuse, at Buffalo, who gets what? Albany. If one gets more, the other two are jealous. So, you know, it's a typical environment that we've been in for many, many years. Things have changed in Buffalo, and you have to give the governor credit. He has changed the whole mindset up there. He has given a shot of confidence. He has not put $1 billion into Buffalo yet. He's put significant money in, but it has not reached even close to that mark yet. He's pledged it over time. But he has done great things. I've been there for so many openings. There's so many things happening up there, people working much closer together. You know, the culture itself, in terms of its partnerships, they had a business competition, 43 North. It was extraordinary. He's done so much up there. And the Rich Funke's comment, which always been a big fan of Rich in the media, and he'll do a great job in his new position as in the state Senate. The governor is coming this way, and I'm not at liberty to say things, but I think you'll see investments coming to Rochester. And keep in mind, we finished out of 10 regional councils. Finger Lakes finished four, $306 million over 4 years. If we finished one with me from Rochester in this area, then I think there'll be a different story. People will always complain we don't get our fair share. 4 out of 10 is a pretty good number so far of all the regions. And I do think you're going to see some great things coming this way starting in very early January of next year.
Feel free to use this program to break any news if you'd like.
Love to.
You can come back here since you're going to be here so often. This is Michael in Rochester. I'm with Bob Duffy. Go ahead, Michael.
Thank you very much. An honor to speak with you, and thank you for your 4 years of service to the state, Mr. Duffy. It's an honor to talk to you.
And thanks,
I'm especially interested in the economic development side and your work in that over 4 years, because the Finger Lakes is at a turning point right now with gas storage expansion having begun in Watkins Glen and geologically unstable caverns. A Texas company wants to put billions of cubic feet of natural gas and LPG in those caverns, and the municipalities have gathered together against this. There have been 150 arrests down at the gates of Crestwood Energy, and I don't know how much you're aware of Paul Hobbs and Johannes Selbach and Louis Barol, who've started winery operations right down in Watkins Glen, basically, three of the best winemakers in the world, and they have just released statements that they are considering holding off development if gas storage goes ahead. And I'm interested in how much you or perhaps the governor is aware of this, given all the arrests, including winery owners from Damiani Wine Cellars right at the gates of Crestwood. Is this something on his agenda now that fracking has been decided? And if not, how can we put it on his agenda so that we don't lose some of these best, amazing winemakers like Paul Hobbs, who came here with no economic incentives? They came here because they think it's the best area, most exciting area to make wine in the world right now. So what can we do to get this on the governor's agenda?
Well, a great question. Thank you, Michael.
Great point. Actually, I'm sitting near somebody who brought something to my attention not too long ago in the news on this. And I have personally forwarded a number of things to our governor's team on this as well. I'll stand by and let the governor make his decision on where he goes down the road. But I will say this, the governor has been an extraordinary supporter of the Finger Lakes wine industry and actually wine industry across New York State in many different ways. And we were at Damiani during the Governor's Cup presentations this year. We were down there and spent about an hour and a half. Down at Damiani and a couple other wineries. They are such a huge part of the economic development in that region. We don't want to lose any of those. And they are, when wine owners and winery owners take those positions in that area, you know there's an issue, because they, to me, are one of the dominant economic development resources down there in that region. And I want to give a plug to Evan, who really opened up my eyes to the winery opportunities in that region with his book, Summer in a Glass, which I think I've read three times so far, and stories about the winemakers.
Flattery gets you nowhere.
It does. But I will tell you, I have a copy. I have two copies, and I have read that over and over again. I have met so many of the people in that book, which I consider an honor. But I'm blown away by the winery owners. And I'm going to just say one thing about them, especially the Finger Lakes Winery. These folks are competitive in a marketplace, but they are collaborative behind the scenes. If one's grape crop is damaged by weather, somebody else comes in and provides grapes to them. They help each other. They help each other succeed, thinking that all boats will rise. I've often said, what a great path for government, for business to take. They are extraordinary people who they live, their whole livelihood depends on that land and on the weather. Why is New York State wine more expensive than what you buy from South America? Because they pay a living wage to the people that work in those wineries who can support their families. So when you spend an extra $4 or $5, you're helping to support New York State families and their wages. So that said, I've listened very carefully, read about the interest on it. I have no idea what originated with this gas storage. I do not know how they ended up coming here, But I will defer to the governor in terms of the position he will take. A good lieutenant governor never gets out in front of the governor, and I'm his lieutenant governor right till December 31st, and I know it's on his plate. I will just defer to him on that one.
I will also say that Bob's praise is very kind, but I've always said that I wrote the book as a journalist, not as a booster. Some people say, oh, thank you for boosting the thing. And I always try to say, I wrote it because the stories that I chose to tell are inspiring, and they still are in many ways.
Yes,
that's an industry that is doing remarkable work. But I think I can still say that from a journalist and not a booster, and I'm very proud of that. So, Bob, we're already out of time, so if some listeners couldn't get through, Bob, you'll be back on this program soon, I hope.
I can probably walk down anytime. We're a short distance away, and I'm looking forward to being at the Business Alliance. I'm at my last second. I just put thanks Sandy Parker for all her service, and looking forward to being there. And you can contact me at the Business Alliance after January 5th.
All right, Bob Duffy, the incoming CEO of the Rochester Business Alliance, and I'm going to make sure we do bring him back on this program regularly.
Love to.
And a lot of people have been saying on Twitter how happy they are to see you back in Rochester full time. Thank you, Bob. Great to
thanks,
see you.
Thanks, Evan.
All right, short break. Member-supported public radio continues with Connections as we shift our attention to the art scene next, and some live music for you. Stay with us.